Producer Joe Boyd remembers Mick Drake.
The early days.
In 1966, Joe Boyd, an ambitious young American, arrived to London hoping to make his mark in the thriving music scene.
He produces the first Pink Floyd single, and he discovers the English folk rock pioneers, the Fairport Convention.
Yes.
But arguably, he makes his greatest find far from the streets of London.
In Cambridge.
Proper
Cambridge. With Nick Drake.
Nick Drake.
The English have such funny names for class. I would call him an upper-middle-class boy. You know, the upper-middle-class always call themselves middle-class. But, you know, the lower-middle-class also call themselves middle-class. Anyway, he was definitely, he went to a boarding school, he spoke with a very refined accent. He was part of a kind of gilded youth generation of well-off, upper middle-class kids. And, you know, he was very talented in music. He started playing the clarinet. He switched to the guitar. His mother played the piano and wrote songs. And years later, I heard tapes of his mother. And they're amazing. You know, they have these wonderful chords on the piano. And, you know, the style of the song is a bit, you know, very English, very almost music hall, but upper-class music hall, Flanders and Swan, Noel Coward kind of thing. And he started playing the guitar, and I don't know where it came from, but he developed a way of reproducing on the guitar the kind of chords that his mother played on the piano. I heard him first because one of the Fairport Convention told me about hearing him at a concert in the Roundhouse. It was a Vietnam protest concert. And I followed up the lead and invited him to come in and bring me a tape. And he brought me a tape. And I put it on at the end of that day and just immediately knew that this was something completely different. A lot of retuning of strings so that he played in very unusual tunings. And his articulation of arpeggios on the guitar and the whole way he used the guitar to underpin his songs is completely unique in my view. I mean, it's so strong and so central and so devoid of solos. I mean, there's nothing about guitar solos in there. It's just a way of orchestrating a song in a complexity that is staggering.
3 hours from sundown, Jeremy flies, hoping to keep.
That was a selection from Three Records from Sundown by Charles Maynes, winner of the 2009 Director's Choice Award. The story was first presented on Podstancia, a podcast dedicated to independent media in Russia. We're proud to say this is the story's radio debut. To hear the piece in its entirety, visit thirdcoastfestival.org. We, as the directors, highly recommend it.
I've heard this story, or one exactly like it, in the lore of several cultures.
You're listening to the Third Coast broadcast. I'm Gwen Maxey.
Once upon a time, there was an old woman, or was it an old man?
Some stories deal with themes so classic they become almost timeless. Our next documentary has that archetypal feel. It's the story of a journey, a father and son, a stranger coming to town, all the classics layered on top of each other, but told with a deeply personal and particular voice. Hamish Sewell grew up in New Zealand, the son of a Kiwi mother and an American father. But when Hamish was young, his dad, Jim, left the family and returned to the U.S., where he fiercely rediscovered his Southern roots and fell completely out of touch with his children. 30 years later, Hamish and his sister, Penny, traveled to Alabama to reconnect with the father they hadn't seen in decades and to meet his new wife, Linda. There they discovered that even when they were all physically together, they were still worlds apart. Their senses of history, politics, and justice were almost diametrically opposed. That didn't stop them from trying to reach across the great divide that separated them. Here's a selection from the 2009 Third Coast Bronze Award winner called Battle Flagging Father. It begins with Hamish and Penny's visit to an old plantation.
I'm standing across the road from, what's this place called, Pen? Oaklands Plantation. It was one of the biggest plantations in the Mississippi. And we're standing right on the banks of the Mississippi River. And along the banks there's a swill of branches and dirt, and there's an old rusted out barge across there, and probably about a kilometer away is the other side of the Mississippi. And we've just had a tour of the house, which was kind of interesting. There were, I think, something like 90 slaves here. And for Penny and I, for my sister and I, this is a bit of a dilemma. You know, the legacy of what this stuff means and how we sort of figure that out. Penny, she was quite horrified to see that our great-great-grandfather was a slave owner, and one of his slaves was called Penny. When he died, she was able to choose who she served.
I'll always remember that day when I sat down with you in your lounge room.
Hamish, I would have done it differently if I could truly turn.
And we talked, man to man.
You said that.
Hell, it was good.
It was a bad mistake. It was a irrational response from being put in a position where I just felt I just wanted to get away. I just wanted to get away.
Well, those fears that a dad has about his son turning up and wondering what on earth he's after.
You know, I mean, that's why I wanted to come here, really, is because I get to come into your home, I get to see kind of, you know, how you...
All the fears that I come with as a son...
Half of my life in here, 36 years here in the States.
Who really, if I'm really honest,
you know, spent back in New Zealand again,
just wants to say that
that's the extent.
He loves you and
anyway,
he misses you and... He's always missed you.
If any point you feel like I'm going too far.
I loved you children. I remember all the good times we had. You know, if I could turn the clock back and have been able to... I enjoyed doing things with you. I find I trust you for a start. I find I know you a little more. Not that I know anything enough to say I know you, but at least we've broken the ice. You are coming into a point in my life where I'm ready to try and share. And it's been a while since I've really felt interested in looking deep inside me and trying to come up with honest answers.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
They laid waste to our land.
I don't believe the South was wrong to stand up for, you know, for what the people wanted. I mean, it was a vote of the people. I mean, each state had to get the vote to secede.
The war happened over the denial of the South to be able to export their cotton.
Lincoln had us blockaded. We could not get any medicine up here, and they couldn't get any medicine up there.
They tore up the railroad tracks. They burnt the cotton and the gins. Lord, they made everybody suffer.
That's a widow lady.
A Confederate widow.
That was made to us for us by a friend.
Looks like Scarlett O'Hara.
Yeah.
She's probably supposed to be who she's modeled after. You gotta pick her up and look up under. She's got petticoats on.
All kinds of very pick her up. She's sitting in a flower vase.
Yeah, she's sitting in a flower vase.
We just found it was the easiest way.
A little skirt. I mean a little say look at the slip. She's got this. And she's got this. She's got on pantalettes. Look at her. And she's got her hat, she's got a veil, she's got a purse over here. I mean, she's just, you know, everything was thought of. Now, we stuck the flag in her. We felt like since she was a Confederate widow, she needed to be paying her respects.
Oops, you're on here. Here, let me help you.
Yeah, she doesn't want to go down in there. Yes. But why won't she came out. Oh, she's got her legs crossed. Yeah. No wonder.
There we go.
Just like a woman, ain't it? And this is Stonewall Jackson, Robert Stonewall E. Lee, Jackson, Jefferson Davis.
His arm and then his life 2 days
just about fell over when he said, "You have to understand, the war changed the South." Or...
the two of us just went, "We get it." War changed South. But I had a very interesting time asking Linda yesterday. You know, she's just asking, "What do you think it would have been different if the secession had been successful?" And she's not very clear about, you know, what she would have liked to have happened, but she says it would have been better.
Heather Wainwright!
You know, I'd always been scared of actually meeting you, Jim. What it would do for me, what I'd discover in myself. Years ago, when I first thought about making contact with you after my mum had died, I wondered about the man that you would see and what you'd think of me. And I got pretty hung up on that for a while, I have to say. I wanted you to know me. I wanted you to know what I looked like. I wanted you to hear me. I can remember one day when my flatmates had gone out, I decided I was going to take some photos for you. I decided that they had to be essentially me. Whoever the hell that is. And I worked out, did the self-timer on the camera thing. And what a bizarre bloody bunch of photos they are, I tell you. I've still got them to this day. I'm too embarrassed to show them to anyone, really, but they're a pretty good reminder of how confused and stuffed up I was about the whole thing of having a father.
That was an excerpt from Battle Flagging Father, this year's Bronze Award winner, by producer Hamish Sewell with Tony McGregor and sound designer Judy Rapley. The story goes on to chart the growing tension between Hamish and his father, Jim, and ends with both a confrontation and a tentative reconciliation. It originally aired on Radio I on the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. To hear the story in its entirety, to listen to an interview with Hamish, and to see pictures of the Sewell family, visit thirdcoastfestival.org. Now, you might be wondering what happened between the two men after this documentary aired. Remember, they hadn't seen each other in 30 years when the liberal son came poking around his conservative father's life with a microphone. And Hamish was very open about how much he disagreed with his dad's political views. While they're still grappling with their significant differences, they've stayed in touch, and in fact, both of them traveled some distance to Chicago for the Third Coast Awards ceremony in October. Here's Hamish accepting his award.
To come to Alabama and to meet my father after so many years of not having contact was confronting. It was difficult for both of us. And really, I suppose, if any credit needs to be given to anybody, it's to my father for his bravery in inviting me to produce a radio program of this nature and for his commitment to his relationship with me. So I'd like to just invite Jim to come up here and say a couple of words, please.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here tonight. It's the end of a long journey. I had 30 years of absence from my family, and the phone calls that we started to timidly reach out to each other resulted in me hanging up. We had many differences of opinion. This has mellowed into a relationship where my eldest son, Brett, came to see us in 2006, and Hamish and Penny came last year. We covered so many topics, but the love that has now started to come back into the family again is the real joy of this whole operation.
Battle Flagging Father was one of hundreds of entries submitted to the annual Third Coast Richard H. Driehaus Foundation competition. And this August, a group of august judges from around the radio world gathered together for the difficult task of naming just 9 of these entries the best of the best. Each story submitted was carefully crafted. Each was interesting in its own way. But what makes the winners so outstanding is all the elements of story in perfect harmony. Sound, structure, writing, design, and the X factor. Undefinable, perhaps, but you know it when you hear it. This year's Silver Award winner is a standout on all fronts. From producers Mary Beth Kirshner and Rebecca Weicker, a story of friendship, acceptance, and identity. Kirshner and Weicker documented the relationship between two young girls as they met, got to know each other, and became buddies. Nothing unusual there. But as the story unfolds, we learn what makes their relationship both so ordinary and so unique.
Put your shoes anywhere.
Lily and Thomasina are hanging out late on a Saturday night. They've asked their parents if they can have a sleepover. This is only the second day they've known each other, but that doesn't matter.
I said hi, and she said hi, and we became, like, best friends.
And here we are right now.
They live on opposite sides of the country, but other than that, they've got lots in common. For starters, they're both 8 years old.
She's nice and I'm nice.
I wish I had straight teeth. Like, I have two big teeth.
I have crooked teeth on the bottom, so...
We have crooked teeth.
And they go on.
We're both awesome. We both like ice cream.
Do you like Chinese food?
Yeah.
I like Chinese food. That's another thing. I can't think of anything else.
Only when asked do they mention their other extraordinary bond.
I don't feel anything like a boy. I'm a girl. And that's all I have to say. I'm a girl.
Thomasina and Lily are both transgender, born with the anatomy of boys, but who now live as girls.
And I'm sure there's a lot of people like us, but we just don't know it yet.
Lily looks completely like a girl, chin-length blonde hair and pierced ears. She loves wearing her pink sneakers with her all-pink summer dresses. Thomasina has long, wavy brown hair and delicate facial features. She wears kick skirts and headbands and two-piece bathing suits. Usually it's hard for Thomasina to talk about how she feels on the inside, but this weekend with Lily, it's different. Before drifting off for the night, lying on the floral quilt of a big bed with Lily on her tummy and Thomasina propped up with pillows, these two get to share what's usually kept secret in their 8-year-old lives. Before this weekend, neither one had ever met anyone who's transgender.
When I first meet someone, I don't tell them anything.
Once you get to know them, would you tell them a little bit more?
Actually, now I've been doing something where they later sometimes figure out. And I actually have this one friend who doesn't know a thing about it. And I actually kind of like that, but she doesn't know a thing about it. She just thinks I'm a normal person.
Yeah, I like it when people think I'm normal.
Thomasina and Lily and their parents are in a hotel in Seattle at a conference for families with transgender kids.
Thomasina, we didn't sign in. When we came in this morning, she wasn't
It's
here.
Just its second year with only about 20 families attending, all of them in the middle of figuring out how to raise children unlike any they've ever met. These parents came together to compare notes about things other parents simply don't have to deal with, like this dilemma that came up with Thomasina's parents, Fred and Mandy, before the conference.
In the car yesterday when we were driving with our child, and our child, I'm saying carefully for a reason you'll understand in a second, said, when you talk about me, say she.
It's the first time that we've gotten a instruction to us. Mommy, when you talk about me, say she, all right? And I said, okay. Daddy, when you talk about me, say she. And what did you say?
I said, okay, I heard you.
Yeah, but you didn't agree.
I understand that that's what you want. That's the best I can do, is to understand that's what you want.
Okay, but we did sign her up. That's for today. And then if you want her to come to day camp again tomorrow, you just sign her up again in the morning.
This conference marked a turning point where Fred and Mandy agreed to use the pronoun she to refer to their son as their daughter and to call her by the new name, Thomasina. For most of her life, Thomasina was called Tom, named after his Irish grandfather. Tom was a boy who, from age 2 or 3, always liked pretty dolls and flowy clothes. A lot of boys go through that phase, and Mandy and Fred were open to it. They let him wear dresses when he wanted. They always felt Tom's non-traditional style showed flair and a free spirit. Mandy and Fred are both actors. Fred has a sister who's gay. They sent Tom to progressive schools in Southern California from the time he was little, and Tom's nursery school friends didn't notice a difference. But when Tom still wanted to wear girls' clothes in kindergarten, his parents started to pay attention. And Tom was starting to express some confusion.
We were in the garage, actually, and I don't know what precipitated this. And he said, I'm mad at God because I'm a girl, but I'm not. And he said, you know, Mommy, you're my mother. You know what I mean. You know who I am. I had never been so brought in.
That was part of Tom Girls by Mary Beth Kirshner and Rebecca Weicker, winner of this year's Silver Award. It originally aired on This American Life. To hear the whole story, in which both the parents and the kids eloquently struggle with questions of identity, gender, and the unkindness of strangers, visit thirdcoastfestival.org. I'm Gwen Maxey, and you're listening to the 2009 Third Coast broadcast. The Third Coast International Audio Festival is an independent, nonprofit media arts organization. Our work is made possible with lead support from the Richard H. Driehaus Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Coming up after the break, the Gold Award. A radical activist turns FBI informant. But how and why? Stay tuned. It will all become clear. This broadcast comes to you from the Third Coast International Audio Festival and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Radio Maria in downtown Champaign, now with a new dinner menu. Tapas served every evening until 2 a.m., along with lunch on Friday from 10:30 to 2:30, and brunch on Saturday and Sunday. Information on menus, wine, and beer lists is at RadioMariaRestaurant.com. WILL programs are made possible by Community Concierge Magazine. Every issue includes an event calendar, attractions, and maps, as well as a business and shopping guide. Community Concierge Magazine is distributed throughout East Central Illinois and always presents Champaign-Urbana at its best.
And now, the envelope, please. It's time to reveal the winner of our top prize in the 2009 Third Coast Richard H. Driehaus Foundation competition. The gold award goes to a complicated story about a complicated man, a larger-than-life character who undergoes a philosophical and political transformation so extreme, he alienates almost everyone he knows, risks total social isolation, and puts his own life in danger. Slowly, over time, Brandon Darby went from being a well-known radical activist to an FBI informant reporting on the activities of his former allies. And tracking this complex story was reporter Michael May. Here is his Third Coast Gold Award winner, My Way or the FBI Way.
I first met Brandon 2 weeks after Hurricane Katrina. I did a story about him for our local radio station in Austin. And Brandon had this crazy, true story to tell. He bought a boat and drove from Austin to New Orleans after the storm to find his friend, a former Black Panther named Robert King Wilkerson, who lived in a flooded neighborhood. Brandon couldn't get the boat into the city, so he decided to wade in. At the time, he told the story like that was the only reasonable thing to do.
I came under an overpass, and there were law enforcement officers on the overpass, and they stopped me, and they told me to wait there, that I didn't have a reason to be there, a right to be there, and asked me who I was, and I told them I was going to get my friend. And they said, you can't do that, and I said, well, you know, I don't mean to be rude, but you're on an overpass and I'm down here. And so I really don't see how you're going to stop me from getting my friend.
So Brandon literally swam into the fetid water. And when he couldn't reach his friend's house on his own, he somehow, while stranded on a fence pole, badgered the Coast Guard into rescuing Wilkerson. This story became famous among activists in New Orleans, and it sums up Brandon pretty well. A mixture of heroism, recklessness, and arrogance. Brandon Darby looks a little like an action hero. 6 foot plus, stubble, he's got some muscle. Good looking in a rugged movie star sort of way, down to the cleft chin. And he didn't become a political activist after taking a Marxist theory class. He didn't go to college. He was the smart guy from a crappy Gulf Coast refinery town who spent a lot of his teenage years running away from home. He lived on the streets of Houston and was in and out of group homes and treatment centers. By the time he hit 20, with an 8th grade education and a GED, he learned what he took as the central lesson of his life. People in power lie and take advantage of people weaker than themselves. And when he moved to Austin, he discovered radical politics. He showed up at the anarchist bookstore, read up, and started channeling his anger towards the U.S. government. And it all came to a head after Hurricane Katrina.
I believed for years that the government was out of control and that it didn't have any concern for the average person. And then Katrina happened, and it reinforced it 500%. I was very dedicated and sure that it would be a huge error on my part to spend any time trying to work with or change our government, and that they just were so rotten to the core I needed to do something about it, and that maybe I needed to become a revolutionary who believed in overthrowing the state.
So we moved to New Orleans. And post-Katrina New Orleans was the perfect place for someone who believed, sincerely and literally, in the overthrow of the U.S. government. A wasteland with no functioning central authority is a paradise for anarchists. It was a chance to prove what Brandon and others already believed. Government sucks. We can create a better world without it. So he and three other more experienced activists started up a relief organization with $50. They named it Common Ground.
In the vast plain of devastation that is the lower Ninth Ward of New Orleans, there's a little blue house. It shines in the sun like a wildflower amid the wreckage. And it was here, at the little blue house on Desland Street, that we found something rare in New Orleans, a real success story, an American success story. It's called Common Ground.
That's from Nightline. Common Ground might have been heralded as an American success story and a wildflower by the time the mainstream media found them a year later. But at the beginning, it was a bunch of outraged radicals, anarchists, promising to deliver relief by any means necessary.
They were the only relief group here in the Upper Ninth Ward.
Ken Gaspard grew up in the Ninth Ward.
Red Cross was handing out food in uptown New Orleans and where no damage was happening. You couldn't find Red Cross down here in the Ninth Ward. To this day, I will not give Red Cross a dollar of my money for that reason.
Within weeks after Katrina, Common Ground, with Brandon leading the Ninth Ward effort, became a force, providing meals, health care, and help with gutting houses, all for free. They didn't have permits or anything. They just did it. And police did not like it. Common Ground was being run out of the house of a former Black Panther named Malik Rahim, and Brandon says it quickly became a target.
The police would show up every night at Common Ground at Malik's house, and they would find some means of intimidating the hell out of us.
Specifically, what would they say?
Arrest everybody for things. Like, I almost got arrested because I didn't have proof that my car was registered, and I was like, well, look at my sticker. And like, yeah, but do you have a receipt for it? And I was like, I don't think I need a receipt. They're like, Mr. Darby, if you don't have a receipt, I'm going to arrest you. And it's like, well, okay. You know, like, I guess you're going to arrest me because I don't, this, you know, like, really find infractions to arrest us with.
We did have a hard early going.
Major John Bryson with the New Orleans Police Department was in command of the Ninth Ward.
One of the first people that I ran into on the streets was Brandon Darby. I invited Darby and his staff over to the 5th District Police Station where we met in a trailer of all things. That's where we were actually working out of, temporary trailers. And it was a very interesting first meeting. Brandon kept interrupting what I was telling him, what was expected of them, and he laced my expectations down. Police, he kept saying that, you don't understand, I'm an activist. I said, yes, Mr. Darby, I know you're an activist, and I'm just being just as polite as I could be, but Brandon was at my throat. He kept saying that, you don't understand, we're going to be videotaping you, going to be audio taping you. I mean, he was very aggressive meeting, I would say, on his part. But over the coming days and weeks and months of watching them do what they did, bringing in, my God, doctors and feeding people, it was just a work of art. And I'm not saying this is what they said. I'm telling you what I saw. And we were scratching our heads trying to figure out, well, where's the government?
At the same time Bryson was changing his mind about Common Ground, Brandon began changing his mind about Bryson. It started when he got a call from Bryson.
He said, hey, Brandon, I was driving around my district thinking of how much I dislike you and what you stand for. And I was like, I was just thinking about how much I dislike you, too. And he was like, but I came across all these youngsters who said that you had given a medicine to deliver to elderly residents. A lot of them I know. And I said, yeah, that's what we do. And he goes, well, I'm having a hard time disliking you when you're doing stuff like that. And I said, well, I'm having a hard time disliking you when you're talking to me like this, you know? And that was the start of an interesting friendship.
Brandon, to his surprise, started thinking that maybe he and some of the police in New Orleans were actually on the same side, trying to do the same thing, fix a crippled city.
That was Michael May with the beginning of My Way or the FBI Way. Now, don't worry, we are going to let you hear the end of the documentary, but because we, sadly, don't have time to play the entire story, I'm just going to catch you up on some of the vital details before we jump ahead. Brandon Darby visits Venezuela, where he meets with an official in the leftist Hugo Chavez government. Now, Brandon believes he's there to talk about securing aid for Hurricane Katrina victims, but the Chavez people have other, more revolutionary ideas in mind. But their ideas frighten Brandon, and instead of returning to America energized for revolution, he returns understanding that a violent overthrow of the U.S. government is not, in fact, what he wants. He goes back to Common Ground, the organization he once led, but increasingly he's disillusioned with his work there. And the feeling is mutual. Members of Common Ground are getting fed up with Brandon, too. They see him as macho, controlling, and selfish. Shortly after returning from Venezuela, Brandon leaves the organization and moves to Austin, Texas. And that's where the story picks up again. Here's producer Michael May.
When Brandon left Common Ground and went back to Austin in the beginning of 2007, he turned towards something quite exotic to him, ordinary life. He bought a house. His daughter was born. He tended his garden.
Just tried to fit back into, I guess, normalcy, you know, not being in New Orleans, not being in the situation I was in New Orleans. But I think at the time, I was having a very difficult time making sense of my views, I guess.
Brandon also missed the intensity of Common Ground and the moral certainty. He had an idea for an organization called Critical Response, where he would lead medics into war zones to help civilians caught in the crossfire. They'd go to Lebanon or maybe Darfur. But instead, one of the acquaintances he'd made while planning Critical Response, an older man who ran a Palestinian charity, came to him with a very different plan.
An idea to put explosives on motorcycles so that they could go through the barricades that were meant for vehicles.
Where?
In Israel. And I didn't agree with it. And the person went further to ask me to help them funnel money to Hezbollah and Hamas. And I was like, no, I'm not doing this, man.
Brandon was going to let it go, but the man started asking other people to do it. People Brandon knew. So he went to the one cop he trusted, Major Bryson of the New Orleans Police Department, his one-time adversary, now ally. It was Bryson who suggested that Brandon tell the FBI.
So how do you do that? You just walk into the FBI office?
No, you don't. You could just walk in if you wanted to, I suppose. I mean, they'd probably talk with you. But, well, a meeting was set up. He gave me a phone number. I called the number. And then that man brought another agent with him. And we met and had a cup of coffee and talked, you know. And I left, and I drove back to Austin, and it was just a strange experience. And I was really bothered by the fact that I had met with the FBI, you know. I felt like I had done something that I would never be able to tell anybody about. And then ultimately it began to bother me. I was like, well, wait a minute. I just did something that probably prevented people from getting blown up. You know, who are the people I associate with that if I said, hey, I tried to stop violence, like they would be upset with me.
And the more Brandon thought about it, the more he remembered how many times he'd come close to violent political action himself. Over the years, he'd been asked by friends to get together and rob an armored car for the revolution. He'd been invited to train to do eco-terrorism. He'd had long, serious talks about committing arson to fight gentrification. He never did any of that. But now, maybe because he'd gotten older and less angry, or because of his experiences at Common Ground and in Venezuela, he decided he needed to take a stand against it. He called the FBI back and volunteered to become an informant. And in my interviews with him, I asked him over and over, why go that far? I could see why he'd gone to the FBI in the first place, but to become an informant? To go undercover? Not many people would choose that option, especially people who just bought a house and had a kid. I ran one theory by him, and he didn't react well.
My desire is to be a hero. Like, that's a really, I feel, kind of a negative way to portray that. I don't think that's a fair analysis, you know?
Why is it negative?
I don't think I want to be a hero any more than someone who's a firefighter. Are they firefighters because they want to be a hero?
Yes.
I don't think so.
How would you call it then? I mean, you put it like...
I think some people feel a natural desire to stick up for others.
Why is this up to you?
Because it's in my lap. It's in my lap. You know, that's the deal, is some people...
But Katrina wasn't in your lap.
Well, it kind of was in my lap, though. That's the thing, is... It was in my lap because I had access to buy a boat, and I knew that I had just the right mentality that I was going to go and get my friend, you know, and I knew that nobody was going to tell me I wasn't, and so I did it, and that's what I did, and that's kind of been how I've always done things. That's what my brain naturally does, you know. Some people are really good with numbers and their accounts. My brain thinks of ways to fix things I think are wrong.
It was during this conversation, roughly our 17th, that I finally understood. Brandon kept using this analogy. He'd say, if you walked by an alley and saw someone getting beat up, wouldn't you try and stop it? And I thought, Well, yeah, but how often does that happen? Brandon is always walking by that alley.
There's some words I get sensitive about, like hero complex. I kind of think all of us as activists have some degree of that. You know, I definitely know I do, you know. But I think more than that, the thing that doesn't feel good is when you could have saved someone and you don't. You know, that sucks. When you can fix something and you don't. You know, when you can hold people accountable and you don't.
So Brandon's work as an undercover informant for the FBI began. Brandon met David McKay and Brad Crowder, the two guys who were convicted of making Molotov cocktails, at a meeting in Austin at the Monkey Wrench bookstore in February of 2008. A group called the RNC Welcoming Committee was recruiting protesters for the Republican National Convention in St. Paul. The goal was to shut down the event with swarms of activists, including some using black bloc anarchist tactics. Protesters you've probably seen with black bandanas covering their faces, making human chains, pushing dumpsters into the street, breaking glass. The FBI sent Brandon to the RNC Welcoming Committee meeting to check it out. Brandon thought spying on them was a waste of time, but he says when he got there, the group used a phrase that alarmed him. They talked about protests involving a diversity of tactics.
It's a common term used in radical leftist circles in relation to arson.
And Brandon says from that moment, it seemed possible to him that something violent might happen at the convention. Not likely, but possible.
I think ultimately, there's a lot of bark and no bite with a lot of people. You know, I think you have a lot of people who are very reasonable and rational, as much as I might not agree with the way they do things sometimes, like pretty reasonable people. But the thing is there are always someone who will do it, you know, when the space is created for them to do so and the support network is set up for them to do so. I felt like there would probably be some who would do something crazy, even though the majority wouldn't.
For the next 6 months, Brandon spied on guys who were essentially younger versions of himself, two Texas activists in their early 20s who didn't have college degrees and turned to leftist politics to help them make sense of the world. Brandon identified with them, especially Brad.
I related to him a lot, and I related to David McKay somewhat, too. I thought he was probably a pretty decent guy who was getting caught up in some stuff that I would have hoped he wouldn't have got caught up in. My initial reaction to he and to Brad was like, I should try to find a way to just get these guys and tell them the people they're associating with are being idiots, you know? But again, that's not the role I was playing.
The FBI told Brandon that the role he was playing was to be accepted by the group, but not to be the leader. But Brandon had an odd way of trying to pull that off. He became a sort of caricature of his former hardcore activist self. In Brandon's own FBI reports entered in David McKay's trial, he talked about berating David and Brad as tofu eaters who needed to bulk up, saying he was going to the RNC to shut the f*** down, and bragging that any group I go with will be successful. Brad Crowder wouldn't agree to an interview, but David McKay remembers the meetings with Brandon.
You know, we had a lot of discussions about how we need to be, how he was criticizing us about our physical, you know, where we were physically. He gave Brad a lot of, flack about that, because Brad's a really skinny individual. He's very, not very athletic and stuff like that. And he always, like, put him in a chokehold out of nowhere one time just to test what Brad would do and like things like that.
Why did you put up with this?
Well, we really didn't want to. We really didn't. And we really didn't feel very comfortable about Brandon for a long time. But it always came into play that we had never done anything like this ever. We didn't want to just be these guys that just showed up without any like credentials or any kind of credit. And like that's what everything that Brandon was. You know, he was the activist guy from Austin. And like with him, we felt like we were legitimate. Being a revolutionary instead of an activist was kind of what he made the situation feel like. That we weren't just going here to protest, but we were coming here to, you know, fight for our beliefs. not just to voice our opinion, but to actually fight.
Brandon says that if he was busting their chops, it was because he was trying to discourage them without stepping out of character. In other words, the very things that David says egged him on are the things Brandon says were supposed to stop him.
When they talked about their willingness to go to prison, then what I did was begin to tease them about the fact that they weren't prepared to go to prison and probably weren't prepared to make those kind of decisions for themselves, saying, like, you guys are, you have no muscle mass, you would get killed in prison. So, yes, I did say things to try to discourage them from doing stuff. And I felt the pull between my role as a person working with law enforcement and my role as just an older person who had some realizations in my life and wanted to discourage people was a huge dilemma for me the entire time. And it was something that I struggled with the entire time.
In August 2008, on the eve of the Republican National Convention, Brandon traveled to Minneapolis with David, Brad, and a few others in a van dragging a trailer full of homemade shields and other protest equipment. Brandon tipped off the FBI, and as soon as the group parked the U-Haul, the cops raided it and took the shields and everyone else's stuff. David and Brad were angry about the shields, and they didn't want to show up at the protests empty-handed. So David McKay says they made 8 Molotov cocktails in about 15 minutes with supplies they bought from a Minneapolis Walmart.
It was just gasoline in a bottle with a little bit of oil, and then he duct taped the top, and that's it.
Where did you do it?
In the bathroom. In the tub. Yeah, no, it was incredibly easy. The fumes were really strong, so right after we went outside, and by that time it was nighttime, and we kind of just set up on the roof, and he's going to get mad at me that I'm going to tell you this, but, you know, we talked about, before we talked to anybody, we were like, I said to him, I hope this isn't one of those when keeping it real goes wrong scenarios, and we kind of laughed, and no, we were very lighthearted about the whole situation.
When word got out to the rest of the activists about the Molotovs, they weren't so lighthearted. In fact, they were angry.
When we found out like how the group felt about the situation, you know, that impacted us a lot because, you know, we're like, well, we're going to bring something to the group of people, you know, that we'll be able to use and implement, and, you know, we'll be doing another good thing. We'll be helping them out. And when we heard from them, you know, what you're doing is ridiculous, stupid, and dangerous. You know, that made us feel like, well, we need to rethink this.
What follows is a depressing series of events, no matter whom you believe. David and Brad never used the Molotov cocktails. They left them stuffed in bags in a basement while they went out to protest. But Brandon, on behalf of the FBI, asked David what he planned to do with the Molotov cocktails. David now says he didn't want to lose face with Brandon, so he made up a plan. He suggested that he and Brandon use the Molotovs that night on a parking lot filled with cop cars next to a checkpoint. If David wasn't serious about doing it, as he testified, he made a terrible mistake by telling an FBI informer that's what he was planning.
I didn't want him to think that I was scared. Scared of what was going to happen or afraid of him.
Brandon, for his part, says he did everything he could to stop David. But again, the way he did it seems as much like goading as discouragement.
I told him a number of times, that I didn't think it was a good idea. If he wanted to back out, I wouldn't tell anybody. Nobody would know. I did say I'm a revolutionary, and if you want to do this, I'll do it with you. But as a revolutionary, I think people should probably wait till they're 30 before they make decisions that could put them in prison for 2 decades. That's what I said to him. I said it over and over again. He's not old enough to make that decision. And I'm glad I didn't make decisions like that in my 20s. I think people should wait till they're 30. He got very adamant and angry that he was going to do it, whether I helped him or not. And I was like, fine. And at a point, I let it go.
David and Brandon agreed to meet at 2 a.m. But when the time rolled around, David blew it off. And then he stopped responding to Brandon's calls. At 4:30 a.m., David was awoken by a police officer pointing a rifle at him. He was asleep next to a girl he'd met in St. Paul. It was around an hour before he was going to the airport to fly back to Austin. Since then, Both Brad and David have pled guilty to the possession of unregistered firearms, which is what the law calls Molotov cocktails.
Oh, here's a good one. You're a whore.
A few months later, Brandon is sitting at his desk reading emails.
Brandon was curious how much money the FBI compensated you for being a sewer rat. Why didn't you advise and guide your friends towards nonviolence? Why not? Because you must be a brainless, heartless FBI whore. Congratulations on your brilliant career of whoring your soul. I'm kind of envious. Does it pay well to be a whore?
It didn't pay well, actually. Brandon got a total of $12,750 from the FBI, plus $3,028 in expenses. As a result of his informing, he's been skewered in the alternative press and shunned by many friends. He's gotten death threats.
Are you feel 100% certain that law enforcement was the right way to go with this?
No, I don't feel 100% certain of anything. It depends when you ask me. You know, it depends when you ask. Sometimes I feel bad enough for them that I don't go to sleep. They made their choices, you know. I made my choices, and we both have things to live with.
Here's what Brandon has to live with, as I see it. In one of the first emails he wrote to the FBI after meeting Brad and David, he worried that they might end up as, quote, some strange form of collateral damage. I don't think this means Brandon somehow encouraged Brad and David to make the Molotov cocktails, as David's lawyer argued, and as activists all over the country now believe. But I do think that if Brad and David had met Brandon as he actually was, not in character, not playing a role for the FBI, but as an older activist and a natural leader who was profoundly regretful over the extremism of his past views, he would have stopped them from making Molotov cocktails, and Brad and David wouldn't be facing years in prison.
That was My Way or the FBI Way by independent producer Michael May, winner of the 2009 Third Coast Gold Award. It originally aired on This American Life. To hear this story in its entirety, to listen to an interview with Michael about how he reported this very complicated story and what Brandon Darby is up to now, visit thirdcoastfestival.org.
The first sentence of our childhood.
Tell me a story. You know, every kid in the world knows that.
That we all remember once upon a time.
Tell me a story.
Once upon a time, there was an old woman, blind but wise.
Thanks for joining us for the 2009 Third Coast broadcast, featuring the winners of the Richard H. Driehaus Foundation competition. I'm Gwen Maxeye. All good stories, as you know, must come to an end, and we've reached the end of this story. But the stories never stop at Third Coast. We're a year-round audio festival, and we organize public listening events, conferences, public audio challenges, and more. Check us out at thirdcoastfestival.org. The program is produced by Delaney Hall and Katie Mingle for the Third Coast International Audio Festival and PRI, Public Radio International. The executive director of the festival is Johanna Zorn. The artistic director is Julie Shapiro. The festival is made possible with lead support from the Richard H. Driehaus Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Additional support is provided by the Boeing Company Charitable Trust, the National Endowment for the Arts, Chicago's Navy Pier, American Airlines, and ExploreChicago.org, the City of Chicago's official tourism website. The festival is produced in partnership with the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University, and it was founded in 2000 by Chicago Public Radio. Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide, and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Once upon a time.
PRI, Public Radio International.
10 University of Illinois journalism students took on the roles of foreign correspondents earlier this year during a reporting trip to Romania. Revealing Romania is the documentary of their in-depth reports. At the center of the stories is the migration of Romanians in search of work to more prosperous European Union countries such as Italy, and Romania's efforts to lure them back to their homeland. That's Revealing Romania, Friday afternoon at 1.
Mostly sunny in Champaign-Urbana today with a high around 45 degrees. Mostly clear skies tonight, the low 32. Sunny skies tomorrow with a high of 58. Partly cloudy tomorrow night, the low down to 40. Partly sunny Sunday with a chance of rain, the high around 48 degrees. Mostly cloudy Sunday night, a chance of rain, the low 35. Mostly cloudy Monday with a high of 42 degrees. You're listening to Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3, Urbana.